and moral terror by your friends.
Catapults of propaganda. The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I am Sharon Gilbert. And welcome everybody to our bunker. Today is the day.
Yes, 6-6 of 06. Well, I've
we
heard it said that actually.
It's been a quiet day.
It really has been. But I've heard it said by some people that actually today is 6-6-8 because you got to add the 2 in there, so it really doesn't count. We actually missed it in 2004, which was the real 666.
Oh,
yeah,
rats.
I know. It's like arguing when did the millennium actually start. So be that as it may, the only thing that happened of note today was the new movie, the remake of the movie Omen, and the release, of course, of the 89th book in the Left Behind series.
Yawn.
And we started reading through those books. And once we got through about the 6th book, we said, you know what? They're going to stretch this out for 12 books.
And sure enough, they did.
They did, but we didn't see them licensing out the franchise like Tom Clancy.
No, we
didn't
see
that. And like Tom Clancy, they were also making movies. And, of course, there's the video game that's coming out later this year, which is... that's a whole other story. That's disturbing. We won't go there tonight.
And the action figures and the lunchbox.
Yeah, yeah. That'll go right in the, what is it, the remains of the day lunchbox? Back in the storage closet where it sits.
Oh, yeah. Just in case that you didn't catch that reference, that was from...
Best in Show.
No, not Best in Show.
Waiting for Guffman.
Waiting for Guffman,
yeah, Waiting
yes.
for Guffman. One thing we need to mention after last night, you know, of course, last night we mentioned the prediction by the Bible Code group, the Lord's Witnesses, who said that there is an 85% chance of the United Nations Plaza being nuked this coming weekend. We indicated that they were an offshoot or related to the Jehovah's Witnesses, and one of our listeners pointed out that there are some definite doctrinal differences between the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Lord's Witnesses.
Okay, well, I made that statement based on a chat room, a forum that I found for Jehovah's Witnesses that said the Lord's Witnesses were an offshoot of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Gordon Ritchie, who's the leader of the Lord's Witnesses, is a former Jehovah's Witness who apparently has taken onto himself the ability to unseal the Book of Daniel and the prophecies contained therein, whereas the Jehovah's Witnesses, I gather, maintain that parts of the Book of Daniel are still sealed and that we don't really know the meaning of it yet.
Hmm.
Now, you can call that splitting hairs, I suppose.
Yeah.
And both the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Lord's Witnesses deny the doctrine of the Trinity, which is considered pretty core doctrine for Orthodox Christianity. Mm-hmm. So,
well, there are a lot of other doctrinal things in there that are frankly ate up.
But we did
want to
make that
distinction.
We'll
see what happens this weekend, though. Yep, that was good to say.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens this weekend, if anything. You know, we've seen over the last few days, we've seen lots of stories about the Canadian raid. Of course, there was the British raid.
Mm-hmm.
But the Canadian raid that rounded up 17
young
suspects.
Muslim men, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story out today. In fact, yesterday you talked about the picture that the police gave out to the
right.
photo op that the police gave out to the reporters and that they had put some props in there, or at least one, that we know of. And there is a story out today, Canada plot allegedly involved PM attack, Prime Minister attack.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the first paragraph. Spectators and family members of some of the 17 Muslim men accused of plotting terror attacks in Canada were stunned Tuesday when they heard allegations of plans to storm Parliament, take hostages, and behead the Prime Minister.
Hmm.
Let me tell you, it's like the government is using the press to prejudice everybody and anybody who could possibly be on a jury.
That's a good point. That's a good point. You come right out and say, you know, they were planning to behead the prime minister. That would tend to lead the and this is a pretty high profile case.
And let me tell you, anybody who watched the videotapes that were available a couple of years ago online of the beheadings that took place overseas,
yes,
those were hideous. No, I mean, they were chilling. It was so hard to watch, and yet I watched each one of them at least once just so I could say I had seen it, just so I knew what it was that had been done.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw these words, "and behead the prime minister," it's the first thing that flashed into my head. It's a very prejudicial thought to have.
That is true. And it's interesting that this is being portrayed as a case that has very far-reaching implications. And I was listening to the Homeland Security, the Northeast Intelligence Agency's podcast on my way home from work today.
A great podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And Doug Hagman has participated in some of the investigation here and has some intelligence that relates to this case. And his sources indicate to him that there may be dozens more arrested as a result of the two-year investigation that culminated in the arrest of the 17. Now, we say the arrest of the 17. Only 15 were brought to court because two were arrested in 2005 trying to cross over the Peace Bridge from Buffalo into Canada on weapons charges.
Oh,
so they were already in jail.
That's very interesting because the media has been using that 17 number over and over again.
Right.
17
now,
were arrested.
Yeah. Let's talk about the inquiring minds of the media. Did anyone in the media ask, well, if you guys seized 3 tons of ammonium nitrate, why did you have to bring a sample bag down here that was not seized in the raid? What of these other items here would indicate that these 17 are dangerous terrorists? As we talked about, we're not saying that these 17 young men are guiltless. What we are saying is that in the current climate in the United States especially, but in Canada as well, we're being conditioned to look at things like this and say, oh, they are dangerous, when in fact all of the items that were in that display at the press conference, on display at the press conference, are items that could be found in the majority of American homes.
Most suburban homes have all of those things in them.
Even here in Missouri, where we do have a concealed carry law, that 9mm Luger would not be impossible to find in many homes.
Yeah, and again, we don't keep those in our
home.
And I think probably a lot of people don't keep weapons in their homes. But there are some people who do.
That is correct.
For instance, if you work in law enforcement, you are likely to have something like that in your home.
Yep.
Well, yeah, exactly. As you say, this is bothersome because it's almost like, this is an extreme example, but it's almost like the Salem witch trials. He's a witch. She's a witch. No, she's a witch.
Right. We'll put him in the ducking chair and drop him into the pond. And if he drowns instead of floats, then we'll know that he's actually a witch and he's guilty.
Now, and I just want to bring up the Carl Schwartz interview that we did a few weeks back. And you probably were going to bring this up as well. He was talking about McMaster's at that time.
Yes. McMaster University was the site, was the place at which some of these students were studying.
Mm-hmm.
Ahmed Ghani, who was a 21-year-old, a health sciences graduate from McMaster's, but the gentleman who Carl said was flashed up on a television screen that he and his then-girlfriend saw while they were down in Little Rock was a student at McMaster University, and he was alleged to have stolen nuclear material from the on-campus nuclear reactor.
Mm-hmm.
And when they contacted the FBI to notify the authorities that they knew where this guy was, they were basically told, shut up.
Mm-hmm. And it appeared that there were two of this young man.
So it would seem.
The young man that Carl's friend knew up in Canada, and then the young man who was actually from Florida.
Mm-hmm. So it's...
Did I understand that correctly?
Well, that's where he was originally from. He was from, his family was in Florida, but he went to school at McMaster's.
Okay.
He went up to Canada to go to study.
Okay, I misunderstood that part of it then. But I thought it was another case of, wait a minute, we've got two of the same person in two different places.
Yeah, no, it seemed it was the same guy. It's just that The point was that when they notified the authorities that they knew where this guy was, they were basically told to shut up, and they were the ones who were then put under scrutiny by the FBI.
Well, yeah, they even saw him on the road.
Yes, exactly. They saw him driving in the U.S., which meant that he'd gotten into the country, even though he was supposedly one of the most wanted terrorists in the land. Now, again, this may well be, as it appears to be, and as Doug Hagman thinks it is, a sterling example of fine police work by the Canadians in conjunction with the Brits, who conducted their raid just a few days earlier. And Doug implied that there were some things that are happening here inside the United States that we just haven't heard about yet, but that we ultimately will hear of as many as 100 or more being arrested. Our only point here in pointing all this out is that in today's America, that having old cell phones, batteries, battery chargers, two-way radios, duct tape, and a barbecue grill.
Yes.
There was a piece of a barbecue grill in that bag that they seized. And fertilizer can label you as a terrorist.
Exactly. Well, you know what? If those police just had strap-on wings, boy, what they could do over that border. I mean, come on. We've got a story on Watcher Magazine that I had to post because it's got a great picture with it. It's apparently the UK has a special force that uses strap-on stealth wings.
And those are really cool.
They look really, really cool. And of course, here's what we've been saying for many, many shows. If you see it in the news, it's been going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. So imagine that this is probably something that has been used.
You're probably right.
To infiltrate and gather information.
Yeah.
It's like something out of James Bond.
It really is. Or what was the movie that we saw with the Lara Croft Tomb Raider movie?
That's
where they,
where she just suddenly took off flying off of a building.
Yeah, although she was using like nylon or something, and I don't think you'd get that kind of...
No, this looks a little more sturdy.
Yeah, these are carbon fiber mono wings is what they're called. But it looks like the kind of thing that you'd see in a comedy sketch with a guy, you know, trying to prove that he can fly and, you know...
And it's for gliding, which is what Lara Croft did off the building. And she even asked, how far does this glide? And I can't remember what the answer was.
It was just a couple of miles.
Well, in here it's 120 miles.
Which is quite a long ways. Far enough away that a plane could drop a few special ops type guys out of a plane without crossing into another country's airspace, and yet give these guys enough glide time to get down into a target well behind the frontier or enemy lines or whatever.
And underneath the radar.
No one would expect something as small as a man, you know, a couple hundred pounds, coming in at a couple hundred miles an hour, and with no more of a heat signature than a human body would put out, you know, no jet engine, no jet exhaust to, you know, for somebody to spot either. Really an interesting development. And as you mentioned, if it's being released publicly now, published today in the Daily Mail over in the UK, it's a sure bet that these things have been used for a while. We know the stealth fighter, which was publicly unveiled during the first Gulf War, had been in development for a long time.
Oh, a long, long time. Yeah. You know, the next time I see a big bird fly over this house, I'm going to look more carefully.
There's a story that's been out for a couple of days that we really ought to talk about because this is really mysterious. It was published in Popular Science a few days ago, but it's a story that dates back to 2001. India, in the summer of 2001, was pelted with a red rain, a blood-colored rain, and as much as 50 tons of this mysterious red particles inside the rain fell over this section of India. Scientists have been trying to figure out what this red stuff is ever since then, and we'll post a link to the article in Popular Science, and you can look at a container, a glass container full of this stuff in a liquid. It's the reason this is puzzling scientists is that this stuff seems to be replicating, but so far these little cell-like structures, about 10 microns in size, don't appear to have DNA. They, at least they've not found DNA yet. Now, they're still testing these things to find out what they are. And the first DNA test came back positive, but they've got to do more work on it yet.
Mm-hmm. They look like blood cells.
I'm looking at a picture of them right now. Yeah, they look like blood cells, but the cell walls are thicker than blood cells. Blood cells are actually very thin-walled and tend to die very quickly when exposed to air.
Well, that's the only thing. It's hard to tell from this picture, but the blood cells have a particular shape, too, and I don't see that in this picture.
The other thing that's very bizarre is that these things reproduce plentifully, even in water that is superheated to 650 degrees. Now, remember that boiling point is, what, 212?
What? Repeat that.
These things will reproduce plentifully even in water that is superheated to 600 degrees.
Water turns to steam. That makes no sense.
I know. Water turns to steam at 212.
And DNA falls apart.
The known upper limit for life in water is about 250 degrees. Yet at 600 degrees Fahrenheit, these things are still reproducing. Now, the scientist who's conducting the research on this, Godfrey Lewis, who is a physicist at Mahatma Gandhi University in India, is theorizing that these particles could be extraterrestrial bacteria adapted to the harsh conditions of interstellar space. So, the panspermia camp, those who believe that life on Earth has been seeded from outer space, are pinning some hopes on this on these red particles
that
fell on India.
Well, and of course, they did arrive at a time when a comet was breaking up
over the Earth, right?
So, yeah.
So they're wondering if that is what is going on here. But a microbiologist from the University of Sheffield, England, a fellow named Milton Wainwright, says, "Let's remember that even if these structures, even if these cell-like things don't contain DNA, it doesn't necessarily follow that they came from outer space."
Exactly.
So,
but let me, for those of you who know that we like to talk about certain films and television shows and books that are predictive programming, let me jump to, because this does, it follows, The War of the Worlds. If you have not seen the remake of The War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise, you've got to. You really do. In fact, I just watched it again this afternoon because there's so much in there. But just so you know, I don't think this is really revealing too much if you haven't seen it yet. But there is an aspect of the alien invasion that involves blood cells.
Yeah.
And blood cells that grow into things.
Yeah. Yeah. The blood is the life, Mr. Renfield.
Yes. Yes.
Mr. Rumsfeld.
Just a little thought there.
Speaking of life, we should note a story that we just discovered minutes before we hit the record button tonight. USA Today has published a story that scientists at Harvard and Children's Hospital Boston have announced today. That would be Tuesday, June the 6th, that they now have the green light to clone human embryos that could generate stem cell lines for specific diseases.
You and I had a few minutes to talk about this before we hit the record button. You know how I feel about this, and I'm sure many of our listeners know how we feel about it. Stem cell research is not being done. Cloning research is not being done to cure diseases.
No.
Because it doesn't work.
No.
Adult stem cells do work.
Yeah, because when an adult has stem cells removed from one part of the body and then those cells are used for treatments, you eliminate the risk of, well, actually two things. Mm-hmm. First, the risk of rejection because it's come from the patient's own body. But secondly, the adult stem cells don't have that annoying little tendency of the embryonic stem cells to continue growing basically unchecked, which is just another way of saying cancer.
Exactly.
Yeah. There has never been a successful test of embryonic stem cells in a human patient because they've never gotten beyond testing them in lab animals where the lab animals have actually lived.
Exactly. So that excuse is just, that's off the table.
Right.
So you have to ask yourself, why do they really want to clone?
Right. And as I've said before, I hope that the only motivation here is that somebody's looking at the dollars that can be earned, the money that can be made from setting up the world's first cloning factory. However, I think there's more to it than that. And as you've heard us say before, and maybe we should repeat it more often, we think that the things that we see in the news each day are just the shadows from the real spiritual battle that's mm-hmm. taking place around us. And that there's another more insidious purpose for the creation of clones.
Well, you know, as far as movies go, you know, I just tend to think this way. Okay, what movie is out there? Godsend. Have you seen Godsend?
No.
Oh, Robert De Niro.
Oh, yes, yes, that one.
That's right. The boy who dies, and then Robert De Niro, the doctor, comes along and says, would you like your son back?
Mm-hmm. Right. And it raises some interesting questions, as does the movie The Island, which is another movie that deals with the topic.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. You know what? If you just want a list of movies, either write them down as we say them. We should probably have a link where it's
post
just
a list
movies,
of our, yeah.
list of must-see movies.
Yeah, and of course, we haven't talked about all the symbolism in the movie that we've been watching all weekend long, which is The Rock.
Oh, gosh, there's so much in The Rock.
I'll tell you, Saturday morning, I woke up, and Sharon had been watching the movie. It had come on cable, and she said, I hadn't realized all of the Masonic symbols in this movie. And so we went back and watched it again, and I was like, you're right.
Yeah, the forehead slapping that was taking place that morning. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there. Also, today I was watching The 4400.
A new series that
came out
on Sci-Fi last year and just sort of hung under the radar. We never really got into it.
It's really, I don't think it's developed a big following yet, but there is a lot of stuff in there, and it has to do with the unveiling of the superhuman and how that next phase, that advanced human, is going to take us into the new age. Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, this is a very insidious show.
Well, we're going to do more research on that because we're still just now scratching the surface, but it appears to be a lot of predictive programming in the 4400 that pushes or promotes or at least is seeking to raise the public awareness of transhumanism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not like the X-Men movies don't.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah. Mutants will save us.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, we've been seeing that kind of stuff. I remember back in the 1970s and 80s that there were cartoons where you saw they were part human and part animal.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And the heroes, you know, they were rejected because they were dog men or whatever it was.
One of Nicole's favorite series of books when she was younger, right after you first came out here, in fact, was Animorphs.
That's true.
About kids who were able to transform into various types of animals in order to help others.
That is true. Well, there are lots more stories that we don't have time to get to before we have our interview come on. But I do want to mention a couple of things. And one is those that today is the anniversary of D-Day. In all of the 666 hype, it's gotten lost.
That is very true. And there were a lot of men who, well, lost their lives in that invasion at Normandy that day. Words fail. It was a one of the greatest undertakings in the history of military, and it was certainly a regardless of how you feel about war, the bravery and the fortitude of the men who stepped off of those boats onto the beaches on that day can't be denied. And there were some really tragic things too, in the panic, in the heightened adrenaline. Some of the landing craft didn't get close enough to shore. In fact, Nicole had a teacher in school, a French teacher, whose father actually came back and spoke to the middle school, you know, a group of 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, and told him about what it was like, his experience in World War II as a veteran. And he said that his craft was one of those that didn't get quite as close to the shore as it was supposed to when it dropped its gate. And these men piled off the end of the landing craft, you know, in the dark, barely light, with pounds of gear, you know, packs and weapons and boots and helmets.
A lot of these guys were 20 years old.
19, 20, 21 years old. And he jumped off into about 7 feet of water.
Mm.
And there were guys who panicked and just never made it in off the craft because they drowned. He was fortunate enough to, or, you know, God had a plan for him. Mm-hmm. And he was able to keep his head and hold his breath long enough to get into shallower water and get his head up above water before he ran out of air.
Oh gosh!
There were a lot of men who weren't quite so blessed. So, and then of course, then he had to deal with the machine gun fire and the artillery fire. So it was not a fun day.
No.
And you know, the memory of what those men survived on that day is to be honored.
And a lot of their graves are still overseas.
Yeah.
Well, that was originally called Operation Overlord.
I think you're correct. Yeah. I should know more about military history of that period, and I don't.
You know more than I do. I just happened to see it in the story today, but I thought that was an interesting story. Lots of other things going on in the world. There's a drought over in the UK. They're trying to figure out how on earth they're going to deal with global warming because it's all of the infrastructure for heating and cooling homes is based on an old temperature model.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're panicking
things have shifted,
about
yeah.
this. They have. But I think another big story is that Solana did go to Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And he apparently delivered some sort of big promise from the EU, what we call Europa,
mm-hmm.
and the United States regarding nukes.
Hmm.
Yeah, so some package was delivered. Some promises were delivered. I don't think it's going to make you...
Halliburton probably sent a message to both sides saying, look, we're trying to hammer down this deal to work on their oil platforms, so just knock it off.
Actually, I was laughing because I pictured Solana arriving in brown shorts for the package. Hi.
Brown do for you?
That's right. Hi, it's not going to work, though, because, and this is a story we've also got from the Persian Journal. It's called Why Iran Wants War. The fact is, Ahmadinejad is a religious zealot. He really believes that mm-hmm. he is paving the way for the arrival of the al-Mahdi.
Right.
Who is now in hiding, and they want that. That's their end-time prophet. Mm-hmm. That's Armageddon. He wants it.
And it's on a collision course with the Dominionists in the U.S. and the U.K. who believe that it is our destiny and our goal to mm-hmm. clear the world of infidels in order to prepare it for Christ's return.
That is the truth. Well, you know, speaking of prophecy, we've got one more guest.
Yes.
In this prophecy series.
He's a fellow who's written an excellent book. We've talked about it before, so we won't bore you with another description of it, but we will put a link to it and to his website so that you can check it out. We highly recommend it. David W. Lowe, the author of Earthquake Resurrection. He's gone through, he studied the scriptures, he's pieced it together, and presents a very easy to understand and scripturally based, logical interpretation of how the timeline will go. Now, you may not agree with his interpretation, but as we've said with the other guests that we've had on over the past month, their positions are based on how they interpret the scripture rather than, say, you know, a dream vision.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because we believe that ultimately you have to take everything that you analyze and compare it against the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth, in our view, is the Bible, which we believe to be inerrant in the original languages.
Amen.
So that's where David Lowe is coming from, and that's why we wanted to have him on, and he will kick off the final week of our prophecy series tonight as we discuss end times prophecy with David W. Lowe.
We're pleased to welcome back to our guest line David Lowe, the author of Earthquake Resurrection. David, welcome to 666.
Hey, Derek and Sharon, it's good to be back on, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come on, even though it's on, this evil day.
This evil day, 666. Who knew when you were born that you would be so illustrious on this very day?
I know it.
Well, for believers, it's a day that doesn't hold any special significance.
No, and frankly, I think we're probably going to get through it without anything, any big deal, other than the Omen opening.
Yeah, and of course, LaHaye and Jenkins putting out their 97th version of the
Left Behind. And David Lowe appearing on PID Radio.
Yeah,
so there's
the high point of the day right there.
Absolutely.
Well, we wanted to wrap up our series on prophecy with a solid look at what the Bible tells us about the coming days and hours, what we can expect in terms of a timeline. And you've done a pretty thorough study in Earthquake Resurrection with some very interesting new ideas, too, and we'll touch on those. But where do you want to begin as far as understanding the timeline of the apocalypse, understanding the final days countdown, if you will?
Well, I think I'd just say a couple things about the book in general. The book is called Earthquake Resurrection, Supernatural Catalyst for the Coming Global Catastrophe. It's available basically anywhere on the internet. I haven't made really inroads into the brick and mortar stores yet. The book's been out probably around 7 or 8 months. So I've just been kind of surviving on word of mouth and just trying to get people to read it and consider it, basically over the internet.
We're right there with you.
Oh, we hear that. You know, this book, it should be on everybody's prophecy shelf.
Well, thank you. Before I get too far, I want to say thanks to a couple people. Tony Bertovoy in Michigan, Terrence in New York, Mike Figel of the Dallas Theological Seminary, and my good friend Peter Goodgame in Hawaii. All these guys helped me as I was writing the book, and just want to say hi to them. I haven't done that on my other interviews, so I'm going to say that. And then there's one special person named Corey Ferguson who helped me with my website design, which is earthquakeresurrection.com. And he also helped me with the cover of the book, which I think turned out pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, I've got a Ferguson who does all of my book covers, too.
That's my maiden name.
Okay, yeah. So just want to say thanks to Corey. And it's okay. I wanted to read a couple reviews, just a couple short lines from people who have read the book and just sent me emails after they had read it. One person says, many of the things that you address in the book have been questions I have had for many years. Another says, my perceived stance on the timing of events to come has changed so dramatically after reading your book. Another person says, it filled in the gaps for me that I've had since beginning my own study of prophecy back in the 60s when I was still a teen. Another person says, I have a completely new perspective on Bible prophecy. Your model appears to fill in a lot of gaps and answer some important questions. Another person says, I'm simply astounded by some of the things I've read. Your book is the best explanation I've read on eschatology. And I've received a lot of comments like this, and I just want to say thanks and praise the Lord for these, that people are actually reading it, and it's helping some people.
Well, Dave, and I'll just interject right now and say that if we thought you were just blowing smoke here, we would say so. But we've read the book,
it really is an eye opener, and things do make sense.
Yeah.
When you go through Earthquake Resurrection, you'll see that David has really tried to ground all of his conclusions in the scripture of the Bible rather than really stepping out into speculative water. We're not going to edit anything out because we agree with the comments of the people who've been sending you those notes. This is an excellent book.
Oh, absolutely.
Wasn't
right.
Just trying to be kind. We really do recommend it, and that's why we've got your book listed as one of our recommended books at all of our websites, peeringintodarkness.com, PID Radio, Watcher Magazine, and so on.
Well, David, the title itself, Earthquake Resurrection, that just begs the question. Why that title? What do earthquakes have to do with a resurrection?
Well, that's a good question. And that kind of leads me into the reason why I wrote the book. There were just problems that I thought some of the traditional prophetic models like the pre-trib, post-trib, pre-wrath, and mid-trib had that made me want to write a book. You know, there's plenty of books out there on prophecy that another person doesn't need to write another book saying the same thing that everyone else has said over the years. So I wanted to write something that was new and hadn't been considered before. And one of the problems, I think, is that there's too much focus on the rapture. There's too much focus on the catching up of the living believers, and there's really not a lot of attention on the resurrection of the dead. And what happens when a person is raised into an immortal body? You know, what happens in the atmosphere? What happens in the surrounding earth when that happens? And another problem I had was that there's just a dogmatic insistence that the tribulation period is starts at the beginning of Revelation chapter 6 with the opening of the first seal and the rider on the white horse being the Antichrist. You know, that there's virtual agreement on almost every pre-trib, post-trib, almost every prophetic model believes that the white horse rider is the Antichrist. And another problem was the placement of the rapture at Revelation chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, where John hears the voice of a trumpet and is commanded to come up here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where the traditional pre-trib model places the rapture. And then it goes on from there into chapter 5 and chapter 6. So those were some of the things that led me into writing the book. So, sure enough, why an earthquake resurrection? Well, as I was studying one day, something just kind of jumped out at me. As I said, let's look more closely at the resurrection of the dead rather than the catching up. And let's see what we can see when a person is raised from the dead into an immortal body. And we have some examples of that in the Bible. And what I learned was there's a provable pattern in the Bible of a shaking of the earth, an earthquake, with when there is a resurrection of the dead into an immortal body. So that was the major reason for the title of the book, Earthquake Resurrection.
So which examples do you point to?
Well, the first example would be Jesus Christ, obviously, and the other group, which there's not a lot of talk about, but there is a group mentioned called the Many Saints in Matthew chapter 27.
Mm-hmm.
Says they were raised after Christ rose from the dead, came out of their tombs, and walked amongst the people in the city of Jerusalem, and were seen by many people. And then there's one other example, which is the two witnesses in Revelation chapter 11, which will take place in the future. But in that chapter, there is a detailed explanation of what happens after they are killed by the beast, and then they're raised from the dead. Now, in all three of these cases, you're going to see a pattern of the shaking of the earth. Some kind of power and energy that is released when a person is transformed and is changed from mortal to immortality, and it has an effect on the surrounding earth. It has effect as far as shaking the earth, some kind of disturbance in the upper dimensions. And when we apply this pattern to what is going to happen in the future with the resurrection of literally millions and millions of people who've died throughout the ages and who are alive at the time, when you apply that pattern, could there be a global shaking of the earth? And I think the answer to that is yes.
Hmm.
So that's kind of the overview of what the book is about.
Of course, in the book of Revelation, we see at least two earthquakes. There's one early on, and then toward further into the book, it says that there's another one that occurs in the city of Jerusalem that is so great that mountains are moved.
Yep. Yeah, there's one in the sixth seal where mountains and islands are moved, and then there's another one in chapter 16 in which all islands and mountains disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty powerful stuff. One thing that's good to understand is when we talk about a resurrection of the dead, what is the difference between the resurrection to a mortal body and a resurrection to an immortal body? So if I were to ask you guys to, you know, give me an example of a resurrection into a mortal body, what would you say?
Lazarus.
Lazarus, exactly. Mm-hmm. Lazarus was raised 4 days after he died back into his mortal body, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The spirit actually returns to the physical body. The body is not fully decomposed. Other examples would be there's a couple in the Old Testament. There is
Elijah raises one.
Mm-hmm. Elijah raised one.
Elisha raised another. Elisha's bones.
That's right. Elisha's bones. When a man was thrown into his tomb,
mm-hmm.
and rose when he hit his bones. And then in the New Testament, Jairus' daughter was raised from the dead, and mm-hmm. Tabitha mm-hmm. in the book of Acts was raised from the
mm-hmm.
dead.
That's right.
So,
but they died again later.
That's right. They died again later. A resurrection to an immortal body means the spirit returns to a physical body, but it is a different kind of body. It's a body that no longer is corruptible. Just like Paul talks about, this mortal will put on immortality, this corruptible will put on incorruption. So the examples, again, we have that are Jesus Christ, the many saints in Matthew chapter 27, and then the two witnesses of Revelation chapter 11, where after they're raised from the dead, after 3.5 days of being dead in the streets of Jerusalem, they ascend up into heaven. So it's pretty obvious that they were raised into immortal bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So now we know that Jesus Christ was the first to be resurrected to an immortal body. Paul told us in 1 Corinthians that Christ was the first fruits of those who are raised into mm-hmm. an immortal body.
Okay.
So this mysterious group of many saints is something we ought to look at. It says in Matthew chapter 27, something very interesting. Just after Jesus died and gave up his spirit, the earth shook and the rocks were split apart and the tombs were open and the bodies of many saints who had died were raised. And then there's a parenthetical explanation in verse 53. They came out of the tombs after his resurrection, went into the holy city and appeared to many. Now, this is the only time in any of the Gospels that this group is mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And it says they were raised after the resurrection of Christ, not just after his death. And that means that they had to be raised to an immortal rather than a mortal body because of a couple of factors. When it says many saints, obviously that's not talking about all of the Old Testament individuals. You guys may have heard a teaching that, okay, these many saints were all of the Old Testament people who had died, you know, under the Old Covenant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard that?
Yeah, I've heard that.
The problem with that is that there's a couple examples in the New Testament where at least two of the Old Testament people under the Old Covenant were still dead. If you read Peter on the day of Pentecost, he talked about David in Acts chapter 2 and said, his tomb is with us unto this day. And he said, David did not ascend into heaven. So, you know, apparently it was common knowledge that David was still both dead and buried,
mm-hmm.
according to Acts chapter 2, verse 29. And that happened after the resurrection of these many saints, the day of Pentecost. And again, in Hebrews, Paul told us that Abel, even though his voice is speaking, is still dead in Hebrews 11:4. So that just means that not all of the Old Testament people who had died under the Old Covenant as righteous were part of these many saints. So, well, what does that mean? That simply means that when the resurrection of the dead in Christ in the future takes place, it's going to include not only all Christians from the first century after, you know, beginning with the thief on the cross up until the present, it's also going to include all of the Old Testament saints who had died but weren't included as part of the many saints.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just going to be a massive group of people resurrected all at one time in the blinking of an eye. So I ask you, can you imagine the power that's going to be unleashed when that moment takes place?
You're talking about millions and millions of people all being
right.
resurrected to an immortal body
mm-hmm.
at the same moment. If the resurrection of Jesus into his immortal body caused the shaking, caused the temple to you know, the cloth in the temple
mm-hmm.
to be torn. Did that happen at the moment of the resurrection or at the moment of his death?
That happened at the moment of his death.
Moment of his death, okay.
That's right. According to Luke, actually, the temple veil tore in two before he died.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's
but according to Matthew 27, the earth did quake and rocks were split open. And that apparently was concurrent with the people coming up out of the tombs and walking around.
That's right, exactly.
Well, especially if their tombs were blocked with rock.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you guys raised an interesting point. If you remember the Passion movie, I assume you guys have both seen that. Well, now, what happened when Jesus died on the cross, according to that movie?
Storms, earthquakes.
Earthquakes, right. The earth split. Mm-hmm. And they show the temple veil, I believe, tearing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And people just running around in chaos. You know, the earth shaking and lightning and thundering. Well, if you read the gospel accounts, you get a different story. And I kind of place the most reliance on John's account because he was there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
John wrote his gospel, and in the third person, he referred to himself several times, such as 19 verse 35. The person who saw it has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth so that you may believe. You know, and Jesus referred to the disciple whom Jesus loved. Well, we know that's John. So what did John say about Jesus' death? Did he talk about an earthquake at his death? No, he did not. It says, just after Jesus had received the wine, he said, "It is finished." He bowed his head and gave up the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't refer to any earthquake at that time. He says, the Jewish leaders asked Pilate to have the victim's legs broken and the bodies to be taken down. So the soldiers were walking around, breaking legs of the other two men who had been crucified.
Mm-hmm.
No mention of an earthquake, no mention of panic and chaos. And then they come to Jesus and see that he's already dead so that they don't have to break his legs. But a soldier then takes out a spear and pierces it, and blood and water flows out. Well, according to John, there is no earthquake at that time. And if you also read Mark and Luke, you'll find the same thing. There is no mention of an earthquake. What I believe we need to do with Matthew's account is to understand that what he was saying was this earth shaking and rocks splitting apart and tombs opening happened at the time of Jesus' resurrection, because when it says the many saints came out of their tombs, it was after his resurrection. That's the timing point, the only timing point that we have of this earth shaking was after his resurrection when they came out of the tombs. Otherwise, you have these many saints just laying in their tombs for 3 days.
With the tombs open and the rocks split.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the tombs open and the
rocks
split.
Should I get out? No way.
No, I mean,
the holiday weekend.
And for Jesus to be the first fruits of the resurrection to immortality, he had to rise first.
Absolutely.
I think that's the key point.
Right.
I'm glad you made it.
So these saints can't just be lying there. Okay, we've got to wait. We can't rise from the dead because Jesus is first. So let's wait for 3 days in our tombs, and then we'll come out. Because, you know, there would have been an earthquake at his death. No, that's not what happened. What happened was there was a shaking of the earth at his resurrection. And the power of that resurrection also caused the earth to shake, and kind of a residual effect on others surrounding him caused them to be raised from the dead as well in that area.
That's an awesome concept and a really new idea, especially as it applies to what is coming in the prophesied resurrection of the dead in Christ and the resurrection of the faithful throughout history. And we will discuss that as well as the timeline of the apocalypse as we continue our discussion with David Lowe, the author of Earthquake Resurrection, tomorrow on PID Radio.
You know, if you love what you hear, or if you hate what you hear from David W. Lowe, you can find out more about him at his website, earthquakeresurrection.com. And if you really want to know more, you can buy a copy of his book, Earthquake Resurrection. We have a copy. I've read it a couple of times. You've read it a couple of times. Mm-hmm. It is a really useful resource. Should be on your prophecy shelf.
Exactly. It's a good reference material, and he did something that I noticed that Peter Goodgame also did in Red Moon Rising. And I'm thankful that both of these guys did this. At the beginning of every chapter, they repeat the timeline chart and show where what they're writing about fits into that timeline, because mm-hmm. it takes, like, if you're like me, it takes repetition in order to make it sink in and understand where we are on this timeline. You know, the only thing missing was a big red arrow that says, "We are here."
Like and, the mall.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, David, I may suggest that for the next revision of Earthquake Resurrection, just the big red dot on the chart say, "You are here." Well, part two will be tomorrow, and again, we encourage your comments and suggestions. You can send them to us by email if you like. Email address is radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And we do have a place for you at the forum. You can come on up to the forum bar, order a side of fries and a couple of burgers, and I wish we had that there. We really do. You know, take out. A little drive-up window where you can get in there.
That'd be sweet.
Don't you think that'd be great?
Yeah.
In fact, we got ice cream tonight from a local dairy, Oberweis Dairy. Fabulous. No growth hormones or anything, and we love it. We get delivery when... But I asked Derek to stop for some ice cream, and we were saying if only they had an Oberweis / Krispy Kreme store. With a drive-up window.
Oh.
Of course, traffic would be stopped. No one could ever get
That's
through.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
So if we just had something like that at the forum, you know what? If we had you at the forum, we'd have everything. So join us, peeringintodarkness.com/forum. It's easy and it's free.
Yep. And, well, what do we got coming up? Next week, we've got investigative journalist Janet Phelan. And in a couple of weeks' time, we will bring back...
Well, we've got Jerry Smith coming up.
Oh, yeah,
he's
going to
be talking about HAARP.
Yeah, beginning next week, we're going to start a series on conspiracies. It's going to be the conspiracy summer here in the bunker.
That's right.
And so we're looking forward to that, the discussion about HAARP, because HAARP, which is the big array of radio telescopes in Alaska that could basically...
H-A-A-R-P, just in case you're not familiar with it.
Yeah, do some research on that. Google that, you know, H-A-A-R-P. Basically, it's an array of radio telescopes designed to superheat the atmosphere. Now, for what purpose? We aren't quite sure. We know what the government tells us. It's for research.
It's for your own good. Don't ask questions.
But we'll find out.
Go to
because
bed.
It just, within the last month, it just officially went online. So it's a very timely discussion that we'll be having.
That is. Also, go to our main page, peeringintodarkness.com. I posted a picture there that one of our listeners sent in, and I just want to say... This is a very interesting picture. It's posted with permission, of course, and we welcome anything like this. Anytime there's something in your area that comes up that you think is worth, you know, sharing with the group, if it's gum, you better have plenty. but it's a picture that a friend of hers took while hiking, and this picture is of a car door. It's very rusty. You can just make out that there's a logo on it. Turns out that it's from the Civil Defense. And what prompted her, which I was able to make out, you know, by really studying it, but what prompted her to send it is because it's a triangle pyramid with an eye in the middle. Of course, the eye is stylized C&D for civil defense, but it's very obviously an eye in a pyramid. So take a look at this and let us know what you think. But it's just another example of the government telling us right up front what's going on.
Or at least elements within the government.
Elements within the government. Because, again, we have said many, many times that we don't think that everybody in the government is evil. If you work for the government, oh, you're evil. No, there is a shadow government. The ones that think that they're really running things. And, of course, the irony there is behind that shadow government are the real culprits. The shadows themselves, the fallen angels.
Yep. And we'll be discussing more about them as the summer goes along, sort of in a tangential way. But come this fall, we'll get into a discussion, a series that we're going to devote just to the Genesis 6 paradigm and why we write what we write, why we talk about all this stuff, and who we think is really responsible for controlling the people who think they run the world. You know, all of these guys in these secret societies, you know, the elite organizations like the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Club of Rome and all these other groups, they only think they're running things when in fact they're just useful idiots. So we'll get into that in the fall. But this summer, just conspiracy stuff. And we look forward to continuing our prophecy series in this week of 666 tomorrow with David W. Lowe.
I do want to say one more thing just as a teaser. Well, I still get lots of emails asking when are the next books in your series coming out. The next books are going to be out very quickly. I'm finishing up the editing. I apologize. I've only got so many hours in a day. But the two books, Signs and Wonders and Darkness, those are going to be coming out within the next month or so. They deal a lot with these shadows behind the shadow conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes much more obvious. In fact, for those of you who know what the Dull Space event is about, Darkness centers around something similar to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'll leave you thinking about that one. And we'll just have to go and maybe watch a movie. Wouldn't that be great? We'll see what we
notes.
Can find. And take notes. Well, listen, until tomorrow, I am Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thank you for listening to PID Radio.
Bye-bye, everybody. Gonna step up to the microphone.